Hey, howdy. Welcome to River Talk, a podcast hosted by Priscilla Macy, Zach Collier, and me, Eric Weiseth. This week, our big topic is rowing, and we have a guest who's an expert to help us talk about it. Peter Fox is back, and we're super excited about that. So, but before we get to that, news of the week. Priscilla, Zach, what do you got to talk about?
So for me, focusing on Oregon legislature, there's Senate Bill 448, which is a bill that is focused on emergency response, what we're calling recreation response, which is, you know, there's an increase to outdoor recreation in the state and related management implications, and then, of course, search and rescue. So it's a bill that does two things. We are going to have a work group put together that involves outdoor recreation interest agencies and law enforcement to see if there's any possible places to reform search and rescue in terms of efficiencies and services, especially to like specialized recreationists like boaters, as well as to figure out a way to employ a voluntary fee that would go to help search and rescue, since fiscally speaking, search and rescue and our sheriff's departments and counties certainly have a lot of trouble. We actually had one county where all of the law enforcement at the sheriff's office quit because they weren't getting paid enough. Wow. And is over in Wheeler County. And the people just like didn't have any time to spend with their families, didn't have enough bandwidth to respond to basic calls. And so funding's a real issue. So this bill will be interesting to see what happens with it and what solutions we get from the stakeholder group.
Yeah, so I'll go ahead. Call me ignorant. Like, I've always kind of wondered this, and I feel like I've had mixed reading on this. But if search and rescue is called to come in and get you, mm-hmm. Is there a cost to you ultimately for that?
Like, so it depends. Yeah, so it depends. Usually not. The most common question is about a helicopter. And so if you get a helicopter called, there's a number of helicopters that might retrieve you, depending on where you are and how dispatch codes it. So, for example, if you ask for a hoist, you're more than likely going to get the National Guard or the Coast Guard, which is free of charge. But if you get contracted to a private first response company, you will get charged. Yeah.
So ask for a hoist.
A hoist.
And also be on the west side of I-5 because Exactly. Everything east of I-5, the Coast Guard won't come to.
Yeah. So that's another. But there is National Guard units all throughout Oregon that can also offer that service. But then, you know, operating a helicopter, there's a lot of variables that I don't understand because I'm not a helicopter pilot. So depending on what time of day, what elevation you're at, what the weather conditions are, you may or may not get that. And you might have to wait a day or two. You might have like, say, a volunteer unit like the Corvallis Mountain Rescue show up. They're a mix of law enforcement, like recreation volunteers and other experts, or you might have a sheriff unit show up from one or two counties. So it's a really complicated and convoluted system. Sometimes you get a bill, sometimes you don't. And that's kind of part of the reason why this bill was inspired, is one, to figure out exactly what the framework for first response is, kind of like what you're saying. Well, do people always get charged? Do they don't? What are the rules? And also figure out when you do have like the sheriff's department that is statutorily required to respond in a lot of times, that they're actually getting compensated for the work that they're doing and they're not being stretched too thin.
Yeah, it's an issue here in Hood River because we're a town of, I think we're like 6,000 or 7,000, 8,000 people that pay taxes, but mm-hmm. tens and hundreds of thousands of people visit the gorge and they go recreate and they're hiking up to the waterfalls in the gorge and people get hurt. And our small sheriff's department is constantly on calls for search and rescue, and we're not properly funded to handle all the tourists. So I know it's a problem here. And same thing with the Oahe. you know, the area around the Oahe, if anybody gets hurt there, the search and rescue comes from far away. They're super limited. And, you know, that county, that's Mount Hood County, I think. I should know that. That county is responsible for search and rescue for all the people that paddle the Oahe River, but none of those people live in that county. And so,
yeah,
you know, the local counties are paying for the cost of tourism visiting their counties in terms of the search and rescue cost.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So there's not a lot of news on it right now, but there in the next few weeks there will be, through this work group, a few solutions proposed, and we are actually working really closely with Hood River Sheriff on this because of that issue that you spoke to, and we've certainly got interest from legislators from Northeast and East Oregon. Like, one of the legislators from Ontario is really interested figuring out how to fund, like what you're talking about, when you have a bunch of tourists coming in that aren't paying taxes and you have a small population county that is paying taxes, they often end up losing money on, you know, like if there's one call that's really involved, that's pretty much their entire budget for the year, if not more.
Yeah. Our county's making a ton of money on tourism, so we have the money. It's just not being sent to search and rescue. So there's probably a way to fix this. Priscilla, are you, I'm always curious, like, what interesting things you're doing. Is this a bill that you, like, are lobbying for? Did you write it? Are you, like, how are you involved in it?
So I'm lobbying for this bill on behalf of Oregon Outdoors. So I'm one of two lobbyists working on this bill in conjunction with the Sheriff's Association. So we're representing the outdoor recreation user group interest, and then we're also working with, like, Travel Oregon and then obviously the Sheriff's Association and the Office of Emergency Management. So it's kind of a, and for Oregon at least, it's a newer thing to be thinking about, like, specific recreation interest when it comes to emergency response and, like, responsible recreation. So I think for us, it feels like an important step, just like the outdoor recreation community trying to continue to be involved in helping resolve this issue, since it's related to a lot of activities and industries that we support. And the Office of Outdoor Recreation, sorry, is also involved in this as well. This is one of their first bigger projects.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome. You could, you know, one of the solutions that I think it was Montana came up with on this was just find yourself, like, a multimillionaire to fund a helicopter operation. So they've got, I think they're out of Bozeman or Missoula, some Google executive funds Three Bear Air. And they basically have some super, you know, like all the modern bells and whistles, helicopter, lift, the whole deal. And they go do rescues for free, like, in their area. What? If you get called by them, they come and they'll pick you up, do the thing. Like, all of it's free. It's all paid for. Staff, helicopter, everything's paid for by this Google executive.
Wow.
So,
we need to find a billionaire.
We need to find a billionaire.
We need more billionaire friends.
Yeah, right?
I'm all for that.
Yeah, let's go find some billionaires to help us with all of our world's problems.
Zach, do you have any news of the week?
Yeah, just, we talked about last week, the Natural Resources Management Act, which includes the Oregon Wildlands Act, is a huge public lands bill. We get these things once every 5 or 10 years, and there's stuff from almost every state in this bill. And it includes the reauthorization of the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which I'm sure everybody is tired of hearing about. But it's permanent reauthorization, and that fund, it funds park projects, land buys, put-ins, takeouts all over the country. This bill is a big deal. There's some also some, like, not so good stuff in the bill, like some public to private land swaps in Alaska and some stuff for people like to shoot guns. If you don't like guns in public lands, you may not like some of the things in this bill. But overall, it's a really big deal. It's a great bill, and it goes to the House next week, the U.S. House of Representatives. And if you're supportive of all these protections, I'd highly recommend calling your congressman. It's already passed the Senate, so you don't have to bug your senators, but it's going to go to the House this week and hopefully pass. And it's going to be a huge deal if it passes next week.
They're saying this is the largest conservation bill in, you know, well over a decade. Is what I've been reading. And it's fascinating to me that that's happening now. But I think it's great, right? Like, take it when you can get it. So it's awesome. Yep.
Yeah. Well, it's the work of, I mean, it's bipartisan. It's not just like, it's not all like liberal conservation stuff. There's some stuff in there too, where you're like kind of cringe a little bit. Maybe you may not like it. So there's stuff that Republicans like too. It's sort of a compromise. And, but I think overall it's a good bill. I mean, if you live in Alaska, you elected those Alaskan senators and congressmen and Congress representatives, congresswomen. And I mean that you're going to get what they wanted. Unfortunately, here in Oregon, we have really good representatives who believe in conservation. So we're going to get some really good stuff done.
It ultimately had, I think, all but six Senate, like, you know, it had almost universal voting for it in the Senate, if I remember reading right.
But, passed 92 to 8.
Yeah, 92 to 8.
Oh. Which is great.
Ted Cruz voted against it.
Wow. Well, yeah. Man. no comment.
Yeah.
Great. Cool. Well, you know, I think one other piece of news of the week that for just you Oregon Outfitters that I thought was interesting is, correct me if I'm wrong, Priscilla, this passed the House yesterday in Oregon, the bill on essentially changing some of the outfitter requirements just to require providing the option for helmets to all clients on commercial river trips.
Yeah. So you have to, there was an earlier version of this bill that we talked about yesterday privately that, required all folks to wear helmets on class three or above, which obviously is not going to be something that passed, and it didn't. So now as outfitters, you are required to make available or for rent or for purchase helmets on any trip that includes class three or higher whitewater in Oregon. And then it also has a few other requirements in the bill about, like, making sure you have a throw bag if you're a professional outfitter, which makes a lot of sense. Making sure people are wearing life jackets, which makes a lot of sense.
Well, that stuff was already in there. I think the only modification to it is the helmet piece.
The helmet, okay.
So they're actually modifying the outfitter, like the outfitter guidelines. But
That's right. Yeah, so everything else was an old requirement. The helmets, now you just have to, like, offer them to customers, which I think a lot of companies have already been doing this, just creates a law around it.
They have. It's interesting. It'll be interesting to see if assuming this gets adopted in Oregon, which I suspect it has a decent chance, what if that ends up setting precedent for adoptions elsewhere. Because I mean, just talking to some Idaho outfitters yesterday who don't offer helmets, you know, universally,
right,
on all of their trips all the time to all their people, and kind of scoffed at the idea, you know, to see if that goes elsewhere. So anyway, interesting thing happening. Great. Well, so I think that's news of the week. Zach, do you want to introduce our guest?
Yeah. Well, I want to welcome Peter Fox. Peter was a guest a few episodes ago, and he's writing a book about whitewater rowing. He's a pretty legendary boatman or guide, if whatever you want to call him, and a friend. And he's just somebody who I look to for great debates about whitewater rowing. And we invited him back to talk a little bit more about whitewater rowing. So welcome, Peter.
Thank you. Hi, guys.
Thanks for being here.
Mr. Binner, if you haven't listened to our previous episode with Peter talking about stories of running, you know, first ascents on crazy things like the Foo and a bunch of other places, definitely go back and listen to that episode because it's my personal, it's one of my favorite ones we've done. So,
I agree. And, we just want to talk about rowing, and I just – like, just to get things going, Peter, you teach a lot of rowing classes now. You're pretty busy with that. And thought we'd just start off with talking about what are some basic principles that you think with people learning to row need to learn? Or what's the way for people to start learning rowing?
Well, the first thing you need to learn is to be able to use the fundamental strokes on the oar. So you can't really start learning whitewater rowing until you can actually make a boat go forward and backwards and turn right and left. So it sounds a little oversimplified, but that's really true. So when we get people come to our rowing classes, a lot of people can pick that stuff up really fast, but some people really struggle with them just being able to make the boat move, the mechanics of making the boat move. So that's, if anybody wants to learn to row, I would recommend that they start just someplace with some flat water and just practice making the boat go forward and back and turn right and left. And that's the best place to start.
And then from there, what's the progression? What are some things people are kind of work on from like very beginner to working towards intermediate.
Okay, so once you can make the have the mechanics of working with the oars to make the boat move, then you have a fighting chance when you get on the river. of understanding what you're doing to the boat with your oars and what the river's doing to the boat, because you know if you can't work the oars, you can't understand what's happening if you go on an eddy line and the boat spins, or if you get in different currents that are moving the boat. So the oar mechanics allow you to have a fighting chance to understand what's you and what's the river, because there's basically two things that can move, have influence on a boat in the river. One is the river itself, the water, all the hydraulics, and the other is what you do with the oars. It's pretty simple formula. And if you can't tell the difference, you're kind of hosed in the beginning. you're rowing, you think you're rowing, and suddenly the boat's spinning and because you've hit an eddy line and you don't. So anyway, in terms of once someone has that basic knowledge to be able to really, you know, just move the boat a little bit, then I think that the complications of what happens when you come into a rapid for someone who's never seen it are such that it's probably best to simplify things in the beginning and just talk about break it down into one technique and one thing you're looking for when you're coming into the rapids. So what we try to do is start by talking about using your pulling stroke and ferrying across the river to miss obstacles. So the first thing that we start with is identifying the obstacles and getting the fundamentals of how to ferry across the river to get into clear channels and get past the obstacles. And some people pick this up instantaneously. Some people takes a little more time, but if you've never been in a rapid before in a boat, it just helps to keep it simple, because ultimately you want to learn to read the water, but you have to start somewhere. And so usually we start people out with that basic premise. Now we usually get groups of about a dozen or so people, or 10 to 12 people. So, and we break them down in our rowing schools into pods of three or four rowers and an instructor. So usually an instructor is working with a small group of people. And in our rowing school, we try as quickly as possible to group people together who are in about the same level of skill, so that we can work with groups kind of cohesively. If you're working with three or four people when you're teaching them, you can see who's picking that stuff up fast and who's not. So if somebody just isn't understanding, you stick with the real fundamentals of how to get the boat into a ferry angle, how to start moving it across the water to get into a clear channel, and how to look downstream and just be able to see, well, there's that rock. I want to miss that rock. There's the riverbank where the river curves. I want to miss that riverbank. And then you let it progress as each individual rower, you know, shows you where they're at, how quickly they're understanding that. So does that make sense to you guys so far?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think one thing that is a common that you and I have talked about a ton is when to decide between pushing and pulling. I think some people, some instructors favor one or the other, or some rowers favor one or the other. Where do you stand kind of on when do you push, when do you pull?
Well, so, you know, if I was working with a single rower to teach them, you know, you could decide very quickly depending on, you know, seeing where that person's skill level lies. Okay, so if you're just working with one person, you can really tailor, you know, that question to that individual. But working with a group like we do, we focus on pulling in the beginning, and because I feel that catching eddies is a huge safety factor for anybody learning to row, and that no matter whether you're going to be pulling or pushing eventually as your own rowing style, it's very important to be able to catch eddies to identify them, to make the move to get there, to cross into the cross over the eddy line, and then stick the eddy. So not just get across the eddy line, but get yourself, you know, into the calm water, get slowed down and stopped. Eddies are a safety factor. They're a communication factor with groups boating together. It's where you communicate, where you talk, you figure out your plans. It's where you it's for camping, for lunch stops. Everybody has to be able to catch eddies if they're going to run rivers. And the strongest and simplest way to learn to catch eddies is by pulling into them rather than pushing into them. So in our rowing school, when we're working with a group of 12, we work for 2 days almost exclusively catching eddies, where we'll go down the river and we'll go through the rapids and have them use ferries, pulling back on the oars to ferry. And then we'll just catch eddies as a team, you know. So if we have a pod of three or four people, we'll identify an eddy. We'll all catch the eddy, you know, one, two, three, four boats. We'll get set in the eddy, get our boats, you know, turned around in a position where we can come out of the eddy together. You know, everybody looks at eddies, and the first impression is you see an eddy line, you see a sort of a calm, smooth place by the side of the river, and you think, oh, okay, that's an eddy. They're all alike, but every eddy is different. You know, some of them are blowing out on the bottom. Some of them, you know, have different currents in them. You have to, when you're catching an eddy, you have to learn to get across the eddy line, and not just, that's not the end. That's the beginning of catching an eddy. Then you have to look around and keep paying attention and stick it so that you're learning to get your boat in a position where it's very stable. And your team is very stable in the eddy together, and that takes a little practice. And so we work on that for almost 2 days. You know, we work on other things as well, and depending on the level of the group you're working with, you can expand it and do different things. But so we spend 2 days of a 5-day rowing school working on catching eddies and mostly working on pulling, because we feel if we establish that fundamental, then it gives you a foundation of safety and of skill level pulling on the oars that will allow you to have that strong stroke available if you ever get into an emergency situation or you need to get in trouble. And it's so that's what we do. And then on day three, as a group, we start talking about pushing. And pushing is, so pulling is a stroke where you can use your strength to impose your ideas onto the water, onto the river. You can pull, and whether you can read the water or not, you can generally on a river like the Rogue where we're working, you can get your ideas across to the river just by using the stroke. But when you start to push a river, when you start to go forward and use the pushing stroke, which is mechanically not as strong for the body, you don't have all the big muscles of the back and legs involved like you do when you're pulling. So when you're pushing, I feel that you have to have a level of understanding of the water to make it work. So after 2 days of pulling and making people catch every eddy on the Rogue River, at doing it as a team and watching each other, before our third day in the water, we have a conversation in camp. We create a little river, a pretend river and a little pretend boat in the sand. And we talk about how to use eddies in particular, not just to stop by the side of the river, but to maneuver a boat, how to cut across in the slower water in a turn that some people call cutting the sea of a turn. How to put a little bit of a tube into an eddy at different places to help turn the boat, how to put an oar in the eddy, how to start using eddies for maneuvering and think about currents for maneuvering. Because after 2 days of pulling and just practicing, people are more comfortable with being able to see the river and not be so nervous and which is my left oar, which is my right oar, that stuff. Most people are starting to get it, and they can start looking more at the water and put more of their attention. And so that is when we teach pushing, and we teach it in combination with using eddies, using the currents to take the boat where you want to go, because I feel that pushing is a stroke that really depends on a greater understanding of reading the water than just pulling. So, all right, does that make sense to you guys?
Yeah. If you're talking to as an aside, if you're talking to an advanced boater, I think there's a lot of people who are advanced who might have a strong opinion about pushing or pulling. Yeah. What would you say an advanced boater should be doing between the two?
I think the advanced boater should be using the stroke that is the appropriate stroke at the moment that they need it in the river. And depending on the river, depending on the water level, an advanced rower should have a portfolio or a toolbox of techniques that they can use when needed. And if you say I'm exclusively going to push, then that can be limiting. So I think you should use whatever you need to, given the situation, the water level, the river, the et cetera.
So let's go back. As you're talking about the progression, you start off just getting used to the oars, and then you start just catching eddies a lot and work on catching eddies. And then you introduce the idea of pushing and some other advanced things. How can you practice pushing?
Well, practicing pushing, I think, I would say the first thing you need to do is have to practice reading the water from your boat, as opposed to standing on the shore and scouting a rapid. You have to start working on being able to read the water, because when you push, letting the current take you where you want to go is a big part of how the technique works. You're not overpowering the water necessarily when you push. You're putting the boat into water current that's going to take you where you want to go. So the first thing, when you really want to start understanding reading water from a boat, the first thing you need to do is read water early as possible. And so you read water before you get into the rapid, because as soon as you can see the entrance to the rapid in front of you, you start looking around at the water you're in above the rapid that will take you to the place you want to enter the rapid. So even before you're in the rapid itself, you're reading the water and trying to allow current to take you where you want to go, rather than depending on having to row the boat where you want to go. So you're trying to let the current do the work. And then as you get closer to the rapid, you start being able to read its features. Always read everything as early as you can, and make moves as early as you can, depending on what you see, because an early move it's like a stitch in a stroke in time saves nine. If you take a couple of gentle strokes pushing to just slide yourself over the piece of current that's going to take you where you want to go, you will avoid coming down right at the top of the rapid and having to do a few hard pulls just to get you into position for how you want to enter. And then that just continues through the rapid. So you read the water early. You try to make your moves as early as you can, depending on what you see. And those two things right there help you be very efficient strength-wise. So you're not needing a more powerful stroke like a pull stroke. You're allowing the water to start taking you, catching little pieces of eddy water, maybe with your tube to help bend you through a turn, or seeing a wave that wave can help, a diagonal wave can help push you back into the rapid. You're starting to see the features that can help let the water do the work for you. And I think that's important for pushing. Would you guys agree with that? To push, you need to really start letting the water do the work for you.
Yeah, I definitely agree, because I think for me, except for the time that I was like a collegiate rower, not super strong with the pushing. And I feel like I can think of so many times where I didn't do the working in advance, and I'd have to like turn the boat around and like pull a bunch to get back online. And so you have to be thinking, like, I don't know. I remember Eric gave me some rule of thumb for how far ahead you're supposed to be looking when you're pushing and setting up, especially with a gearboat. But especially when you're pushing, you got to set up early and you have to use the current to your advantage versus trying to fight it because you're limited by your strength.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I think I always tell people when I'm teaching them to row is that, you know, the best rowers are the laziest rowers.
Yeah, that, I remember you telling me that. Yeah.
You're trying to make this as efficient and easy as possible. Mm-hmm. And the best way to do that is to utilize this, like, dynamic environment that you're floating in, the river. Mm-hmm. You know, if you do it right, it'll do half the work for you.
Yeah.
So figure out how to let it do that, and that's going to make your life way easier and be as lazy as you can. That's why we're not backpackers. We want to float, you know, well, so that's the way I've always looked at it, is just let the river do everything it can to help you.
What I started calling it a long time ago, and I hope this is taken the right way. I call it learning to row like a girl.
And yep.
That's like, you know, that's just a play on words of learning to throw like a girl, because throwing like a girl was kind of a pejorative when I was growing up, you know. Of course, women are unbelievable athletes in all kinds of ways that they didn't get a chance to when I was growing up. So rowing like a girl is kind of saying, you know, is that something you should or shouldn't do? But it turns out women who learn to row without having the possibility of trying to overpower the water tend to have to learn earlier to really work with the water. And watching a good woman at the oars can be a great learning experience for anybody who's thoughtful about being on the river. So when you start working with the water like that for pushing, different places, different people have different rivers, have different styles that they use. Like if you take two rivers that are considered to be pretty difficult that people row on, and you take you take Cherry Creek on the upper Tuolumne, talking to Marty Mack, from Sierra Mac, those guys tend to pull a lot on the oars to slow things down. And they're in a combination oar paddle boat, so they have paddlers in the front and rower in the back, and they have the forward gear of having paddlers in the front of your boat that you don't always have just pushing. But they still, on that river, steep mountain river, they tend to slow down to you know, make their move, slow it down, and then accelerate forward when they want to. Another river that I've been seeing a lot of in the last few years is the Futaleufú, where they also use stern rig rowing frames with paddlers in the front. The company I've been hanging out with down there, they almost exclusively go forward and attack the river or on offense. They drive forward kind of like a kayak would. And so those are two, you know, pretty challenging rivers that at least those two companies, you know, have different styles that they think is dependent on what their skills and the river in front of them. On the Rogue River, there is a great tendency for people to feel that pushing is what you should do. There's people who, there's companies that you see who have been rowing guides have been rowing the river for years and years, who just push forward down that whole river. And I think that that's because the Rogue has enough flat water on it that you have to make miles. So there's a tendency in that river to make miles, and the rapids are simple enough, benevolent enough that you can just push through them. So you see a lot of people who get into a style where they almost exclusively push, and that's a function of just the river that they're on. It's a great river to do that. I have seen situations. We were down there with the rowing school last year, and a company came through that tends to have heavily stacked up gear boats where they carry all their gear in one big boat, and there was a guide coming around the corner above Zangray's cabin, and pushing on the oars to make a move, and they'd gone too far into the corner where it was going to take a lot of work to make that move. And it, to me, okay, turn around and pull, take a couple of pull strokes and you're good. But they took about 100 little pushing strokes because they were determined to not pull. And that was ridiculous to me to see somebody, you know, having working is they had to work that hard, just turn around and use your pull stroke. But they, so I think it's all situational. Is that?
Yeah, I've thought about this exact thing a lot, especially on the Rogue. I think that people who do the Rogue a lot that have the rapids memorized, they like to push because it's more efficient. And also, like, it's a, I think people think that pushing is advanced and they want to consider themselves advanced. So they push to prove themselves. To say like, hey, I really know the river. I can push the whole thing. Where pulling might make more sense. But like guides who run the river, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 times, they memorized every single line. They just push the whole thing because they know it. And so I think about like the wind, for example, the wind's a harder river. If I was running the wind for my very first time, I'd probably pull the whole thing because I want to slow things down, take my time, be really conservative. Whereas now that I've done it a lot, I try to push more and more to challenge myself. And I know exactly every corner, so I know, you know, what's coming up next. I can think about my momentum. So I think it's important. An important thing for me, actually, for people to know is like, and I want to see what you think about this, Peter, is that pushing is something you learn as you get better. But just because you push, it doesn't mean you're better. That like you need to have both tools in your tool set.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like, so, I mean, everybody you see a lot of people, like you said, I think that was well put, that push the Rogue and they feel like, you know, you're not good unless you're pushing the Rogue. So they push everything, but you don't see too many people pushing, the move at Blossom Bar.
Yeah. Yeah.
Excuse the pun, when push comes to shove, they, you know, and there's a move that they have to make that has serious consequences. Just about everybody pulls that move. I don't know. I don't know if I've seen anybody push that move, but
I've tried and it's not ended up well.
But I think there's more to the conversation, right? It's not like when you talk about pulling on the Rogue growing up, you know, where there's this huge drift boat tradition, and I grew up drift boating more than I did rafting.
Nice.
You know, it's the point and pull, like point at what you want to miss and pull away from it.
Right.
Yeah. But you're in a boat that's lightweight with a hard, rigid floor that will glide on top of the water. So you can pull upstream and actually slow the boat down.
Yeah.
But if you're in a 5,000 pound gear boat, or hell, even, you know, moderately loaded, like 14 for a private trip, pulling against the current, like you can kind of slow down, but you're doing a lot of work to not make a huge difference in how fast you're going downriver.
Right.
And so to me, I think about it as like angles. If you're going to pull or you're going to push, as much as that choice is important, it is equally important how the boat is angled against the water.
You know,
pulling across or you're pulling downriver, you know, like downstream ferrying. There's times where I'm actually pulling downstream. Like, you know, is that part of kind of your guys' class when you talk about pulling, pushing, et cetera?
Absolutely. So, I mean, there's certainly an argument that for rowing, the angle is everything. You know, there's the for my book, I've talked to some really interesting rowers. There's a guy named Al Holland who worked for Hatch back in the 60s. He talks about he's kind of a scientist guy, and he thinks of it as you know, really in terms of angles and you know, the physics of it. And then there's people who are more, you know, kind of intuitive about it. There's a story about Bryce Whitmore. Bryce Whitmore was the first outfitter to run California rivers and he started in 1962. Maybe 61. He started on just doing the Sacramento, and then he quickly moved up to the Stanislaus. And everybody thinks of California boating as starting on the Stanislaus River, but actually the first outfit in California, which was the original ARTA, wasn't running rivers in California because it was started because there were a bunch of kayakers who wanted to do longer trips. So they got some Boy Scouts to learn how to row to carry their baggage. And they started doing the Eel and the Rogue. And then they started taking Sierra Club passengers, and they would do the Rogue, the Salmons in Idaho, and then eventually Glen Canyon. They started doing longer trips. And so Bryce Whitmore was the guy who in California started doing two-day overnight trips. And for a few years, he actually had the Stanislaus River to himself. But Bryce worked in California on the Stanislaus, sold his business to Marty Mack, Actonel, and then he moved up to the Rogue, where he outfitted for another 20 years or so. Wilderness World, I think it was. I'm not sure of his name of his company. But anyway, so he and I talked to Bryce, who's now probably 92 years old and lives in Talent, about teaching people to row. And he said, Peter, you can't teach people to row. They either have it or they don't. And I get someone up there, I can put them in a boat in 15 minutes, I can tell whether they can row or not. And so, I don't necessarily agree with that. I think you can teach people to row, but it's a great perspective. And he was hiring guides. He wasn't teaching private, boaters to row. So he made that statement, but then he said, well, but once in a while I would holler at the guides in the boat to, get the right angle. And I said, so you actually did teach people? Yeah. And he said, actually what I did do is I got in the front of their boat with a canoe paddle at Blossom Bar. And as we entered the move, I would set the angle with my paddle, and they didn't like that. They were, they're the guides, in front of their passengers or the big, or their heroes. And I'm getting in the front of their boat and I'm setting the angle for them. And they didn't like that, but setting that angle for them at that move where it's so crucial, where that angle is so important, he didn't mess around. So the one thing of a guy who believed that people just either have it or they don't, he very, very strongly believes that, the one place that he, and the one technique that he would always make sure they knew how to do was set the right angle at Blossom Bar. And so, I think that's illustrative of the idea of how important the angles are. How you address the river with the angles, can be everything. And I think of angles as like, if you think of rowing skills like having a toolbox, I think angles are like wrenches. You have to have all different sizes. You can have a screwdriver, and then you just need one screwdriver, or one hammer, but you need every size, every socket wrench size, all the wrenches sizes for all the different uses, because fairy angles have to be so variable by situation. So that was a long answer to you. But yes, I think angles are super, super important.
Yeah, I think Blossom's one of the best examples of that. You can hop on YouTube and watch videos of people rowing Blossom, and there's people that will take 40 strokes and still end up on the rocks, and there's people who will take 3 strokes and slide right through, and it has nothing, there's no difference other than the angle that they use.
Right.
It's a great, great rapid for that.
It's a great rapid. And, we talked about pushing and pulling and how I would start with the simplest need for reading water, which is reading obstacles, and the simple stroke to understand, which is pulling and ferrying, and then advancing to pushing when you could read the water better. But running Blossom Bar and working with angles, it all starts coming together as one thing, because you're not just pulling at the right angle of Blossom Bar, you're using the water as well. That angle allows you to get the maximum use of that eddy, which as you described, maybe 3 strokes if you do it right, then using that eddy will take you right past the picket fence and into the slot. But you can take 40 strokes to try to do the same thing if you're not using the eddy. So ultimately it all comes together when you're, whether you're pulling or pushing, you are ultimately being a lazy rower, as you put it. You want to be a lazy rower. You want to let the water do as much of the work for you as you can. So the, you know, it all starts to come together eventually.
Eric, earlier you asked about pulling downstream, and I call that a downstream ferry. Is that what you guys call that?
Yeah, that's what I call it.
Okay.
Downstream ferry. If you're pulling down, you know, if you've got the boat basically past 90 degrees of the current, you're actually pulling downstream. We call it a downstream ferry.
Yeah. How do you feel about downstream ferries, Peter?
I love them. It's something that I did both with just ferry angles. So I was trained in the 1980s as a point and pull away from danger rower. That's how I was trained. And it was kind of the dominant style that came from the Arta family tree, which was the first and very influential rafting company in California. And I traced that style back to, you know, where did that come from? All the way back to, you know, Nathaniel Galloway in 1897 or something like that, who turned his boat around to face with his face downstream and pulling backwards. That's, you know, about as far back as I went to find that style of rowing. Though the early drift boaters or the wooden boat rowers on the Mackenzie and in Oregon also kind of invented that style around the same time. So, but then I was trying to figure out, well, when did the downstream ferry angle start to get invented? And there's a couple of really interesting threads. One is in the late 60s, early 70s, as the wharf surplus rafts that started the rafting industry in the 50s and the 60s were wearing out and becoming less reliable, people started inventing and building their own boats. And a lot of companies started building bigger and bigger rowing rigs, sometimes having two rowers in a like a 30-foot boat, you know, trying to get it down the river. And what happened with Arta is they ended up inventing this thing called a snout that was two huge pontoon boat, 22 feet long, carried six people, a ton of gear, 13-foot oars, just a monster boat to try to row. And they had, in the early 70s, they had pretty high water years on the Grand Canyon. And they had to catch eddies with this thing, particularly trying to get into, say, the mouth of Havasu, which is a narrow little creek mouth with protected by a cliff on the upstream side, where you have to get a lot of momentum to cross an eddy line to catch that. And this is a place that any Grand Canyon trip wants to get their passengers in there to hike Havasu, and trying to catch it in these huge boats was problematic, and also it was a problem. Because Crystal changed, there was a huge flood at Crystal that turned Crystal from a non-rapid into the biggest rapid on the river, and you had to get bust through the diagonal waves at the top of that to miss the big hole. Both of those situations called for downstream ferry angles. So I know that a lot of companies working on the Grand Canyon who are rowing kind of developed or figured out how to start using that downstream angle for those two particular situations. And I ended up learning from some Arta guides, because I did a sailway trip, high water sailway trip, where in bucket boats, where I ended up in the lead boat because we kept catching eddies and people being filled up with water and not being able to catch the eddy and everybody pulling out and following. I ended up Puzzle Creek being the lead boat, and I didn't know how to do a downstream ferry angle, and I just rode my ass off sideways, just barely missed that hole, and the giant hole. And the other guys behind me had all just used downstream ferry angles because they were snout boat rowers for Art in the Grand Canyon, just cut to the inside of that rapid and used a fraction of the energy I did. And we got to the eddy down below, and we pretty much rode all of Moose Creek Canyon in one shot because we could never get in the eddies together. We're all sort of exhausted sitting in the eddy, and the head boatman turns to me and says, "Peter, we're going to have to teach you how to use a downstream ferry." So that's how I learned it. And then from high water there, going back to a low water year in the Tuolumne, we started using downstream ferry angles everywhere we could, you know, to to make tight changes of direction in tight spaces, and it was super useful on the Tuolumne as well. So I love downstream ferry angles. I think they give you the most aggressive eddy turns you can get, because you're really adding a lot of momentum to cross the eddy lines and make the turns very abrupt.
Let's go back to the foo la foo for a second. So I hear what you're saying about pushing the foo, and yeah. I think if you know the river, you can push all those rapids in the foo and be super aggressive. And the guides who work there have done a ton of training runs. They have the river memorized. Yeah. But if you were to go to the foo for your first time, and I consider like bridge to bridge on the foo, like doing every big rapid in the Grand Canyon back to back for 5 miles. Right. Mm-hmm. So just for those of you that have been there, for perspective, it's just big volume rapids. If you hadn't been there, I don't think you could push all those rapids. I think in that case, you would do a downstream ferry a lot instead of pushing. Any thoughts about that? Or would you push it? If you didn't know the rapids and you had to run it, do you think you'd still push those rapids?
No, I would not push those rapids. Yeah. And I'm unfortunately, this is just a little too painful to talk about. I was just down there and I tried rowing bridge to bridge 3 times, and each time in each of those runs, I had got my butt thoroughly kicked at least once or twice in a rapid, because I'm just, you know, it's still for me, I would downstream pull, lay, push. And so I was driving a cat, a 16-foot cat, and didn't know the lines well. And I still, even though I was felt like I was right in the right place at the right time, I still got my butt kicked several times trying to push the rapids. And they're rafts. They have paddlers in the front, so they have a much stronger forward thrust with the paddlers. But their cat boaters, their safety boaters, push the rapids too. And so I would just by personal experience, I can say that absolutely that pushing that river is really dependent on knowing right exactly where to be in the lines. And I did not get it. And, you know, I have a fair amount of experience. And, so I really struggled, but, yes, I think, you know, the way I would row, you know, my natural style would be to downstream, but you know, when you're with a group of people that are all pushing, you try to do what they do. So, you know, it was not pretty for me, unfortunately.
I know I went down there once to catboat, and the outfitter I went with, he told me on the phone, he's like, the guides are going to want you to push, but you need to pull. You need to downstream ferry. He's like, don't listen to him. When you get down there, downstream ferry. And then I got there, and the guides were like, you have to push all the rapids. You have to push. And I was like, can I choose? They're like, nope, we push this river. And I'm like, okay. And there's some rapids that I pulled. Like, I wanted to break those laterals I'm pulling, and they kind of gave me the stink eye. Because I think it's tradition for those guys to do it, but I felt like it was because they had memorized the river and the rapids and knew exactly where to be and the timing and the strength, where I didn't know where I was going a lot of the time. So, like, I wanted to have, like, a more aggressive – like, I want to have more power to break through those big laterals to make the moves.
Yeah, and so coming back to the, you know, the original idea of whether you push or pull and what's required for work and how – pushing really requires working with the water and reading the water accurately and well. You know, jumping into a big water situation where there's not a lot of rocks, you're having to read just hydraulics coming down pretty fast into some pretty wild looking entries to the rapids, where it was hard for me to kind of keep things straight and be exactly at the point I needed to be. You put all that together, and I think how the guides down there could do it is, one, they know the lines very well at different water levels. And they're reading the water very accurately. So they're pushing isn't because they're necessarily so strong. It's because they know exactly which wave to slide off of to start getting a little momentum left, which how to catch just a little tiny bit of this eddy here that's going to help them move to the left. And, you know, they're reading the water very accurately and using that water really well. They're very impressive they're very impressive at how well they use the water. And you get, and they're also, you know, most of my rafting career, I mean, I did some, you know, big water descents on the Tuolumne and then the Biobio and the Selway and Futaleufu and the Stikine and stuff. And I was pretty comfortable in that water at that time of my life. And these guys, you know, I started rowing at age 27. A lot of the guides who are guiding now, or who are certainly in the crew on the Futaleufu, have been guiding for 20 or more years, you know, year round in class five water. They have, you know, they're up to speed and up to, you know, their abilities by being challenged in that water as much as they are such that they really read the water accurately. And you see some of these guys float down in their cataracts, you know, who are world-class kayakers and also, you know, guiding and safety guiding in cataracts. And they just make it look like, you know, they're just out for a stroll in the park. And they're, you know, they're surfing off of the pillows above pour overs and just, you know, standing up in their rafts, and they just really make it look easy. And, you know, for me, you know, not having been in that kind of water very much, you know, for 30 years and being old, and, you know, I just couldn't do it. And, but the distinction I think is really, is their ability to see the water and read the water accurately and use it. That's what makes them so good at what they do. And I think maybe that's the bottom line, really, when you talk about learning to row, is eventually you want to really learn to use the water. That's the bottom line. And all of your strokes are just getting you in a position to let the water help you as much as you can.
Cool. I think we're almost done with our time here, but I want to ask one last question that might be controversial or take a long time, but we can hopefully do it quickly. And it's, what do you think about orates?
I, Zach, you and I both started out as pins and clips boatmen.
I still am.
Yeah. And so, so we started out with our oars fixed, and that's how I learned to row. And, I guess, when people start giving me shit about the fact that I don't row with my oars loose in the oar locks, I kind of think to myself, well, if you've done what I did with pins and clips with open oar locks, then let's have this conversation, because you can get really subtle with your oars in pins and clips if you're using them all the time, and you learn to have, you know, a great deal of finesse with the oars, and you can do, you know, a tremendous amount, and they're great having those fixed positions when you need them in big water. But I've, in the last 4 years, I've worked on teaching myself not to use them. So now I can actually row without them. It's taken me that long to change my habits and get used to being able to find those positions. But again, it's kind of situational. Sometimes, you know, Marty Mack, their guides used to use orites, I believe, on Cherry Creek, while the outdoors, I don't think uses them. It's just, I think it's a matter of comfort. I think there's no doubt that in open orlocks, you have a wider variety of choices that you can make with how to feather the oar and being able to twist it if it gets caught underwater, and you can bring it up easier. There's a lot more finesse things you can do. And if you get comfortable with that, people, you know, can do incredible things with it. With our beginners on the Rogue in our rowing school, we put orites on all our oars because that rotation of the oar is one more factor we don't want them to have to worry about when they're trying to figure out what's me at the oars and what's the water moving me around. We want them to keep that equation a little simpler while they're learning. But I don't know. I think, what do you think, Zach?
I use them sometimes, don't use them other times. I do know that if I'm running the middle fork of the Rogue at regular flows, I like open oar locks. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want pins and clips for those, but I would use them. But I do know that the people I consider the best cap loaders in the world, that's like Dave Nissen and yeah. Will Conley and I'm spacing on the guy's name.
Mark Kramer.
Those guys are probably the best in the world in doing the raddest stuff that's ever been done in a catboat. They all use Orite. So I think I think it's situational. And I think there's a lot of people who think you should never use them, or they call them training wheels. And like that kind of, I don't agree with that.
Yeah. So if you're, so enough said. I mean, different strokes for different folks. The, it depends on how you learn. And I think a decent way to approach it would be to try to start out with Orites until you feel comfortable, and then try to take them off and build that muscle memory early with the open oars, because Loxus people can do amazing things with them when they get used to them. So what about you, Eric and Priscilla? What do you guys use?
Well, my thought on that is that, like, arguing that because the guys that are running the hardest stuff in the world in catboats, use them, that they're the right tool for other circumstances. Like, I would tend to argue that rowing a big gear boat on the Middle Fork, the Main, the Lower Salmon, the Rogue, whatever, is an entirely different skill. Is not entirely, but is damn near an entirely different skill set than rowing a catboat on the North Fork of the Payette.
Yeah.
And requires different skills, different rowing techniques, and ultimately different equipment. Mm-hmm. And I think that in my take on this is that rowing like a super heavy gear boat with pins and clips is more dangerous and harder than rowing open oar locks because of that feathering ability. Like,
you drop
a 12-foot oar into an eddy in the middle of a rapid with a 5,000-foot boat, like, you risk getting launched out of the boat. Yeah. But if you can feather the oar and skip it across the top and that kind of stuff, it opens up a lot of opportunities to do things and make moves that you can't do with your oar at a rigid angle.
Yeah.
So I think it's situational. I think both have the right place and both have a wrong place.
Yeah. I disagree with that, actually. I think if I'm running a gear boat on the Middle Fork of high water, I want pins and clips or orites, because I just want to yard on the oars and make those moves. Even if it's a big, heavy gear boat, I see a lot of people row the Middle Fork of high water with what I call spinnies, like the non, like with the, whatever you call it, open oar locks.
Proper
open oar locks. And they're whiffing strokes because they're just trying to yard, and they make these huge moves, and they're missing strokes because they don't have their angle right, and the river's pretty powerful. So, like, my take is if it's a, it's situational too. But I think gear boats work pretty well, actually, with pins and clips and orites. And I know on the Tuolumne, we all ran gear boats with pins and clips forever. So, like, I know it can be done safely.
The other thing I would add in, too, is that when you're rowing a gear boat, especially on some of those rivers, like the Middle Fork's maybe an exception because you have such good current, but the Rogue, the Main, the Lower Salmon, et cetera, if you're a gear boater rowing all day, every day, pushing through flat water or going through flat water, if you can stand up and feather your oars, leave them in the water. Like, it's just a much more efficient way to row day after day after day after day. And that also leaves you more energy when you do have to yard on the oars.
Jacob and I were talking about this morning in preparation for this podcast, and I kind of had the same thoughts. Like, there's definitely a right and a wrong place, and my bias comes from being taught by Eric that taught me, like, feathering pretty early on. I don't think I really understood the value of feathering until I started running gear boats on the Lower Salmon. And I was like, oh, this makes so much sense. It saves so much energy. But then when I started running just like normal trips, going back to kind of like, just rowing people and a little bit of gear on some of the normal, like, class 3-4 rapids, I found myself feathering, like, in some of the deep water to get, like, what's the right word? Like, when you're paddling, like, a kayak, you can do certain things with your paddle, like a Duffix stroke or something that slightly changes the angle of the blade in the water, and you can get a response from the boat. You can do the same thing with oars, and I see a lot of, like, drift boaters do this. And, like, in my head, I think of Roger Goth, who is a really talented oarsman in Oregon, and he'll do stuff like that. And, like, on Green Wall Rapid on the Illinois, he'll catch eddies that some kayakers don't catch, like in a rafter in his drift boat. And it's, if you watch his hands, it's because he's doing these subtle rotations and feathers independently with his left and his right oar. And I can really appreciate the ability to do that even in hard whitewater, where you're limited on your ability to do that if you're locked in. But there's a time and a place, and I think depending on how much you row, where you row, and what you're comfortable with, the values can differ.
Absolutely. So, I don't hear a wrong statement in here. There's all,
just kidding.
Zach. So what I would add to what Zach said is that you talk about, skipping your oar across the surface of an eddy and not, what you learn to do with pins and clips is you learn to put, a quarter of an inch or a half an inch of that blade in the water. And it's, you can achieve a lot of subtle. I mean, you can turn that thing into a paintbrush with the pins on there too. It's just a different set of skills. But it's it's an open question.
But going back to it too, like when I row the Rogue and open oarlocks, and I prefer open oarlocks for most gator boats and multi-day stuff now. There's a lot of subtleties I still don't know. There's a lot of I can feather, but it's not the thing I commonly do. Because I didn't learn that way. So I know there's a lot of subtleties I'm working on myself currently coming from a different background.
Yeah. Okay, you were right. It's controversial.
I knew it would be. But my main thing...
That's why he likes it.
No, well, I mean, I think the best conversation comes from controversy. But also, I think that a lot of people who teach rowing or that are really good oars people that teach rowing or talk about it, call oar rights as training wheels, and that bothers me because I think that there's a place for them, and it's like a lot of people teach rowing. They're like you got to use open oar locks and you only push, and I think there's a lot of openings for like pulling is an important thing, and I think that also using oar rights or oar pins and clips in some examples makes some sense.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that.
So I have one or two more gear questions for you just real quick that I'm curious to what your thoughts are. Full wood or composite oars and thought on counterbalanced oars.
Wow. Mm. Never use counterbalanced oars.
Amen.
But there are some heavy oars out there that I could understand why you might want to make it easier on yourself if you have some really heavy sticks out there. I have beat up old oars that I use. To me an oar is, it's like, oh, I'm a bad person to ask this question because I don't know. To me, an oar is like the hammer. I'm not thinking about the hammer. I'm thinking about driving the nail straight. If you get what I'm saying, so I'm not, I don't have enough experience using different. What do you think? What's your take on that?
It's complicated. Like there's like all things, right? There's benefits in my mind to all the above. Like I love my smoker, my smoker oars for certain things. I love the flex in them and everything else. I think if you're on a drift boat and you're pulling all day, having that flex of a full wood oar makes a lot of sense. That, argument that it's softer on your joints and all that kind of stuff makes a lot of sense. When you're rowing a heavy boat, having a composite oar that doesn't bend nearly as much has some real benefits to it as well. I go back. It really is craft dependent for me. Like I love, if I'm in my dory or a drift boat or a 14 foot boat, I love light wood oars that give me a little flex and everything else. If I'm rowing something really heavy, having composite super stiff oars is nice.
Yeah. Nice. Interesting.
But what I don't like is aluminum oars,
we used with Steve working for Steve Curry and Chile on the BOBO and then on the Futaleufu, the first descent of the Futaleufu, we had yellow cataract oars. They were what would kind of be considered cheap oars, and they, that's what he was able to get down there. And, so You know, but I'm sure I'm not an everyday guide anymore. I'm sure if I was an everyday guide and was working with different oars, I would have kind of, I think what you just said there is very interesting, that that you want the stiffer oars for a big gearboat and the more subtle, you know, oars with a little play in them when you're really, you know, able to feel the water as gently as you can with a lighter boat.
Yeah. I mean, I think there is a counter argument to that again, like, the likelihood that you're going to hurt yourself or launch yourself out of the boat with a stiffer oar is higher, mm-hmm. you know, on a big, heavy boat. You get a little bit more forgiveness, I think, with a full wood oar. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, generally how I feel about it. I like, yeah, sort of that same thing. I like to be able to feel the water a little bit more on the lighter boat and just be able to maneuver more.
But, Eric, have you used square tops?
Yeah, I have. That's actually, so I'm a hater of counterbalanced oars.
Me too.
Me too.
You know, I think if you're feathering oars and stuff, all you're doing is creating more work because you put more mass up by your wrists where you're doing that work. Mm. But square tops are the first thing that Zach would tell you at Sawyer, that they're not a counterbalanced oar.
They're not counterbalanced.
But the idea of putting the mass up there is to help offset the swing weight. So what you're accomplishing is very similar to a counterbalanced oar. Like, the purpose of doing it is very similar. On a big, like, 11-foot oar, I actually kind of like them. I like, you know, you can grab the handle, or I personally just like grabbing the big, like, that huge shaft, like, you get to hold on to, so you get a lot of wrist control that way. And on big oars, I don't like them as, like, a 9-foot oar or even a 10-foot oar, really, but as, like, an 11-foot oar or 12-foot oar, I actually really like them.
12-foot oars? What are you talking about?
We've got a couple big boats.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Do you think
– pig.
I like more club.
Do you think they have flex? Do you consider those – or does they have flex? Or do you call them stiff?
I think they are a softer – I mean, it depends on which ones you get. So they've got the V-lams. They've got – you know, there's a bunch of different versions of the square top. Okay. So it plays into which one you get. So we have, like, a full – it's more – I think it's our – like, their version of an MX. So it's, like, a stiffer version than there are some of their softer versions.
Okay.
The ones we're rowing on the big boats.
Well, I can't help but notice when I pop into the Sawyer retail place in Gold Hill that there's a lot more square top oars than there are round oars now. So they must be popular. It seems
they've been insanely successful with those. Wow. Like, that's been a really popular oar for them. And it floats too, you know, unlike a counterbalanced oar that sinks like a brick. Those will float, so you get some of that benefit still, and or you can drop in the water.
You know,
yeah.
Counterbalancing too is just a handle. On Sawyer, at least, you can swap the handles out, so it's just a handle choice. So you can, like, I have a set of counterbalanced handles here that I took out of a set of oars that are just sitting here. But if I wanted to make a set counterbalanced, I could.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the square tops act as somewhat of a counterbalance, but you like them better, but more in the big. In the longer lengths, is that what?
Well, and they also, so they don't have, it's not like a lead weight, you know, right at the very tip of the oar. It's it's that big wood thing that's spread out further on the oar, so it doesn't, you don't get all that mass up by your hands right there, like directly by your hands.
It's okay.
So I don't think it doesn't feel the same as like a counterbalanced lead weight kind of thing.
It's a very slight amount of counterbalance. The square part is mainly a branding thing. It's mainly like, you immediately can look at somebody and know they're rowing awesome oars. I think it's more of a cool aesthetic than it is anything else.
Shocking.
Yeah.
What you're saying is there's fashion. It's fashion.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd go 100% on that, but I would say there definitely is truth.
How dare you disagree with me?
I don't fully disagree with you. I only partially disagree with
you. I'm just kidding.
But anyway. Yeah, those were the ends of the kind of gear questions that I had.
Cool.
Zach, any other questions?
I could talk about this forever. We're probably going past our time allotment here for you guys' schedule. So maybe we'll move on to Gear Corner and pick this up another time.
Zach, you have any gear of the week?
I do, actually. I did a good job this week. I planned ahead. And it's the Yeti Silo 6-gallon water cooler. And you know, water coolers for our trips have been a constant struggle for me because we've historically used those Gott coolers, which they don't make anymore. They're like circular, really cool Gott ones. They make them, but they're not made as well anymore.
And they're garbage now.
They're kind of garbage, and they fall apart, and they break, and they get moldy. You have to constantly clean them. And
Well, they have the wrong snouts on them. They put the a different, like the old school, really good, you know, like spigot things on them. They don't have anymore.
Exactly. That's the thing, is you can't get the good ones anymore. So I have a handful of the old ones that I treat like gold. I take really good care of. I clean all the time, and they're kind of hidden in our warehouse sometimes because I know they exist. The new ones, you can't buy new good ones anymore. And I've been looking for the next great water cooler, and we found something online last year that was adequate. But Yeti just came out with one that's, you know, it's like $300, but it is perfect. I mean, it's really strong. It has great tie down spots, which most of them you can't tie down to a boat very well or at all. And, or the handles break on them. These handles are bomber. And the spigot, it's fast. It's really efficient. It's fast. It's easy to use. You know, more and more back in the day, people would have a little cup and fill their cup up with water at lunch. And so having a slow spigot was fine. But now people are filling up their liter bottles. And so, you know, the old spigots take forever. And this one's super fast. And so I bought one. I've been using it. I highly recommend it. It's, you know, if you have $300 to drop on a water cooler, this one is perfect.
You could get one square top ore for that.
Priscilla, you have gear of the week?
Yeah, well, I had a gear of the week when we interviewed Emerald, and you guys probably didn't say it, I don't think. So mine is a pocket saw. There's lots of different versions of it. The one that I have is from Amazon, and I think it was like $17, and it's lasted forever. But it's great for, like, if you're doing an oak, and it fits in the front of my life jacket. But it, like, it's a folding saw. So it, like, folds out to, like, a good size, like, gardening saw, but it fits in the front of my life jacket. So it's nice if there's, like, a drop that has, like, a hanging branch that, like, you would, like, if you can just cut the little branch out, it's a runnable drop if you're kayaking, or if you're trying to, like, cut trail and hiking with your boat, it's nice. Or if you're just doing an overnighter and you want to, like, saw some firewood, it makes, like, easy work of that. So I really like it. And I think Jacob and I have had ours for probably close to a year now, and they're still holding up. So for, like, under $20, something that sits in the front of your life jacket, it's pretty awesome.
Priscilla, you carry a saw, a folding saw, in your life jacket?
Not always.
But sometimes.
Think about where they go. They're like the suffer fest. Like.
That is so badass to carry a saw. Like, I'm super impressed. No, I love saws and axes and things. I don't know this about me.
Have you looked into the cord saws? I don't know. That's probably not the right name, but essentially it's like a chainsaw.
Whip
deal,
saw?
But, you know. Yeah,
so
there you go.
The pocket chainsaw, we also have one of those.
Of course you do.
Yeah, those ones, the problem with those, they are really cheap also, and they work really well if you have two people. And there is a way to do it with one person. It's just a little annoying. But they rust really quickly. And we've found that, so like you know, we keep it in a dry bag, which is a little annoying to do because it's going to get wet and dirty anyway. But the pocket saw we find doesn't rust as easy, where the chainsaw, just because it's made of chain, there's more area for grime and rust to build up. So it doesn't last as long.
I'm an aficionado of hand saws, and just
you're
one addition,
awesome.
The, if they're made in Japan, they're better. That's just like a thing I found over time. Japanese made hand saws are pretty sweet.
Yeah.
So this wasn't what I had, but I'm going to go there anyway for gear of the week because of Zach's. Canning Coolers also makes a bomber water cooler.
Did they really?
That we got. Yeah. So we got it last summer, and it's like designed again, like canning stuff. It's designed to be strapped down. We've had a little bit of a problem with the spigot, but they said it was like a one run issue, and they've sent us a replacement and everything. And it's, or they're sending us a replacement. But outside of like that little issue, the thing has been bomber. Like 3 days later, there'll still be ice in it. It straps down super easy, and it's going to be cheaper than the Yeti.
So I need to spend more time on Canning Cooler's website because I have been looking for this ultimate water cooler for 10 years. And the fact that I missed that
too.
Is embarrassing.
I'm with you. I was like watching and watching and watching, and they came out with it, I think, like late last spring or early summer. So I think we got it in like July. But been stoked on it.
Cool.
So
hey, you guys, I gotta go.
All right.
Okay.
Peter.
Nice talking to you guys again. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Yeah,
fun.
You too.
Yep.
Okay.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I think we're done.
On that note, we got to go too. So, yeah. Thanks for hanging out and listening. Hopefully, you know, there's a lot of snow and rain coming in, sounds like, on the West Coast this weekend. So hopefully you're listening to this while you're either headed to the river or back from the river or whatever. Thanks to Peter for coming and doing that, you know, talking with us again. Awesome. Looking forward to his book whenever that does come out. That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Feel free to shoot us some emails, send us some questions. We haven't had a question in a while, so make us feel like somebody listens and send us an email. therivertalkpodcast@gmail.com. Tell your friends about us, rate us on whatever you listen to, all that kind of jazz. And yeah, we'll talk to you next week. Gonna flow me into a new state of mind.